You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Thord,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mock,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Wendy Corbett Dow.
Thanks for tuning into Author Stories. We've got a great show lined up for you today. Be sure to go to HankGarner.com and subscribe to the show. No matter how you listen, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, Pandora, Spotify, or YouTube, you can subscribe to the show and never miss an episode. I'd like to thank some sponsors today. Scribophile is a respectful online writing workshop and writers community. Writers of all skill levels join to improve each other's work with thoughtful critiques and by sharing their writing experiences. We're the writing group to join if you want to find beta readers, get the best feedback around, learn how to get published, and be a part of the friendliest and most successful writing workshop online. Improve your writing by receiving detailed critiques. Learn from a vast collection of free writing resources. Make lifelong friends in our busy community of writers. Writing is a solitary art, but that doesn't mean you have to be lonely. Lucky for you, there are thousands of writers on Scribophile every day, and we're a really friendly bunch. You've never seen a writing group like this one. Join Scribophile today at scribophile.community. For the Words is a unique writing motivator unlike anything I've seen. For the Words is an online writing platform which motivates writers of all backgrounds to increase their word count through gamification. Writing can be challenging, especially when you need to consistently produce a high output of words. By injecting a little fun into the routine and using daily rewards to promote a healthy writing habit, For the Words makes it easier to reach that word count. We're a community of bloggers, professional authors, college and high school students, research scientists, gamers, and first-time writers from all over the world. Come for the words, stay for the fun. Go to thewords.com. Both Sides of the Law, the Casper Halliday NYPD series, Book 1 by Nathan Roden. He shared his father's dream of becoming a detective. A prison sentence was not part of his plan. Casper Halliday's dream began to unravel 2 months before his 16th birthday. His father, Bobby, resigned from the NYPD after 15 years without an explanation. Casper's parents fought. Sirens closed in on their home from every direction. The sound that had always been a source of comfort now brought only humiliation. Bobby Halliday moved out. Casper's dream dissolved into a daily fight for survival. All he wanted now was to finish high school so he could ease his mother's burden. On his 17th birthday, in the throes of depression, Casper made a bad decision. That decision brought him face to face with one of the most dangerous men in the city. In Casper's world, there is laughter and there are tears. There's light and there's bitter darkness. There are improbable friends and unspeakable enemies. The Casper Halliday NYPD series launches with the most unlikely of beginnings. Read Both Sides of the Law today. The ebook edition includes a sneak peek of Ghost Man, Book 2 in the series. Writers, the internet is one of the best tools for research and creativity. It can also be one of the biggest hindrances to productivity, distracting you from doing the seat-in-the-chair, hand-on-keyboard work. Rescue Time gives you an accurate picture of how you spend your time to help you become more productive every single day. Spot inefficiencies in your day and become better at managing your time. Create a goal like spending less than 1 hour per day on email to help you stay focused. Set an alarm to tell you when you spent more than 2 hours on Facebook. Try Rescue Time and use our special discount code for 30% off a Rescue Time premium account by going to rescuetime.com/authorstories. Let us help you rescue your time. The Sam Darling Cozy Set of Six, a box set of the Sam Darling Mystery Series. You can't beat the deal on this huge box set of six complete cozy mystery books, 800 pages, all in one, for a low, low price. Follow Samantha Darling, her dog Clancy, and her beloved George through the first six books in Geraldine Dufresne's best-selling cozy mystery series. Between her big family of five siblings, her charming hometown of Quincy, and a sudden run of murders, Sam has her own work cut out for her. No one asked her to investigate, but that has never stopped her before. Includes book number one, Who Killed My Boss? Number two, Any Meat in That Soup? Number three, Can You Picture This? Number four, Will You Marry Me? Number five, Where is Henderson? And number six, Who's the Rogue? Read the entire series, with a new one coming out this fall. The Sam Darling Mystery Series by Geraldine Dufresne. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm super excited to have my friend Wendy Corsi Stahl back on the show with me. She has a new book. It's the second book in the Foundlings trilogy. It's called Dead Silence. And guys, if you are looking for a book that creeps you out and keeps you turning pages at the same time, this is the book and the series for you. It's a little bit of a departure from Wendy's typical style, but I love it, and I think you will too. Welcome back to the show, Wendy.
Oh, thank you so much, Hank. It's great to be back. Thank you.
We had such a great time talking last year, and I was super excited to see that the new book was coming out and that we would get to chat about it again. What's been happening with you for the last year?
Well, I have been writing like crazy and just a little bit crazy too on top of it. I've been working on the third book that's in the trilogy, and I'm not getting ahead of myself, but that's what I'm writing now. And I'm also, I've gotten into some screenwriting, which is really exciting. So I'm working with a producer now, and I co-wrote something with my son, and I'm working on another screenplay, teleplay, I should say. So that's been a new area of writing for me, and it's kind of been, it's a learning curve. It's been learning a new craft or a new area of the craft.
Well, that's so much fun. Is it, do you feel like, because how many books is this for you now, the new book, Dead Silence? What number is this for you?
This is up over 90. I officially, my name is not on all of them. There have been maybe half a dozen that I did some ghostwriting that I'm not allowed to claim officially, but to me, they are, I wrote the book, so I'm well up over 90 now, but,
that is insane.
Close to 90 in my own name. Yeah. Yeah, it is insane. I am insane, Hank. If there's anything we've learned, that's that.
Right. Well, and by taking on new projects and kind of expanding your skill set by trying new things like teleplay writing and screenwriting, do you feel like that's important as, because you write novels with your eyes closed at this point, but are you always looking for ways to challenge yourself?
Yeah, I think it's just innate in me. It's just something that's just part of my makeup. I like to be busy. I like to be challenged. I've always been that way. I kind of come from a family that, that's in my blood. I always want to stretch and grow and just be busy. I love that. So yeah, am I exhausted? Yes. But challenged? Yes. And that's really important because it keeps things fresh and it keeps me engaged.
You said you were writing with your son? Did I hear that
yes.
right?
Yes.
How fun is that to have a creative family and to share in that?
It's been really exciting, and I kind of fell into it unexpectedly. My older son is actually, he was the English major. He was, he's an amazing writer, and I constantly say to him, let's write something together, let's collaborate, and I think we're going to do that at some point. But he's got a day job now. He graduated college. My younger son is a television major, and he's going into his senior year, and at Christmas time, I just sort of mentioned in passing a screenplay that I kind of wanted to write. He said, hey, that sounds interesting. I'll write that with you. And he never was the reader. I guess he was a closet reader, or a writer. He said he hated writing. And it was just a fabulous experience. We got some interest right off the bat. So we're trying to move ahead with that now. And I'm excited. I'm excited to be spending time. It was nice to spend that time with him, too, on a creative endeavor, because I miss him when he's not here and he's about to leave for London for about 4 months. So,
oh, wow.
It was good. Yeah, it was good. Good bonding time and great creative time.
Yeah. My oldest son was also an English major and graduated and is teaching school now and just finished his master's degree like 3 days ago.
Wow.
And,
congratulations.
Yeah. And so we've been talking about collaborating on something for so long, and he's been teaching during the day and then doing school at night. And he said, Dad, finally, I'm going to know what it's like to not, you know, teach school and then do school all night. And, so I'm looking forward to sharing some
of
that with him as well.
Oh, I hope
you
get to do that.
I know. I think it's going to be fun.
You're rewarding.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. So the new book, and it's when folks are hearing this, it's out everywhere now, Dead Silence, is book two in the Foundlings trilogy, your current trilogy.
Yeah.
When you begin to tell a story like this, did you initially know that it was going to be a trilogy when you first started thinking of these characters and this situation?
This one I did. I don't always, but this one I did. I specifically wanted to write a trilogy. It was what my publisher enjoys having me write. I wouldn't say enjoys, but that's what they want me to write. And I am pleased. So, yeah, I this was conceived as a trilogy, and I think it needs to be a trilogy. This is not a story that could have been told in a single book because of the time frame, and the characters have to grow, and also science has to catch up with my plot, and it wasn't available where the book starts in 1968. So the forensic piece had to be timely, and that took about 50 years and 3 books.
Nice. Well, yeah, and there's so much character growth in this, and there's so much story growth in this that there's no way this could have fit between two covers.
Yeah, no, thank you for agreeing on that. Yeah. I'm having a hard time at this point, sort of, you know, the scope of book three, because I'm trying to juggle all of these threads. It's, you know, even just the three books, I'm like, oh yeah, maybe it could have been a longer series at this point. It won't be, but but it's rich with opportunity, let's just say that. And I wish I could explore them forever.
do you ever like look on your bookshelf at all the books that you've written and think, oh, I could jump back into that story just in a heartbeat?
There's one in particular that I do think I left open-ended, and I would love to revisit, and I did have some interest recently in possibly revisiting it, maybe in a different way. So, yeah. But other than that, I think that when I'm done and when I leave that world behind, in my mind, it's, you know, it's finished. It's over. And I have to move on. And, you know, it's just like in real life, there are chapters and chapters end. And so, yeah, I'm preparing to wrap this up.
Well, that's a great perspective to keep, I think, that this is done. And I told all the story that I could tell, and now it's time to go, you know, dream up something new. I think that's important. Or else, you know, the tendency is that, you know, to edit a book to death and to not leave it alone. And I guess you could do the same with characters and settings, that we just want to keep going back and then never grow as a writer because of that.
Yeah, because they become real to us, and it's just like old friends, you know, it's comfortable. And I think that, you know, that's hard. Like, you have to come to terms with the finality, and you also have to make your choices and live with them. And as you're wrapping something up, I think, you know, that's what I'm doing right now. I'm sort of thinking, where do I feel like I want this to be for my characters? Because I really care about them at this point. But if I have my way, and if they have their way, how should this wrap up? So it's challenging.
When you start thinking of a new book or trilogy, you know, project in the big sense, how does it usually come to you? Do you start thinking about a character? Are you thinking about some odd profession, like a forensic genealogist, and then think of the possibilities of that? Is it a setting? Is it a news headline? How does the creative process usually kick off for you?
I would probably say yes to every question you just asked. It's any one of those things, and sometimes it's all of those things. And at any given time, I have a million ideas floating around in my head. So I think that part of, you know, when you're writing a trilogy, you're committing to a couple of years of living with that trilogy and no, you know, starting no fresh project, or not within that genre anyway. And so, you know, I've had a few ideas floating around. I'm not sure which one, when I finish this, will feel right. But, you know, I'm trying really hard right now to convince myself that I don't just want to write recent historical fiction, because that was really fun for me. I loved, you know, delving back into, you know, this was 1968, 1987. And then the new one is 1968 again, and 2016. And I feel like, you know, those 60s and 80s plots, like there was something really fascinating to me about doing a historical. I mean, that's considered a historical these days, I guess, even though we lived through it. So yeah, I'm leaning in that direction again, and I'm just not sure whether it'll take me or whether a publisher will want me to do that. But that's where I'm leaning, because that was the part that just captivated me after all these years.
Right. You've also written for younger readers. The Lilydale series was very popular. When you are writing a series for YA or for younger readers, are there certain guidelines or rules that you set up for yourself? Or when you're writing adult fiction, do you allow yourself certain boundaries, or is that even something that you think about when you're writing, or is it just the characters, you know, kind of define the story?
Well, the characters definitely do define the story, and sort of the genre that I'm writing in would define the story, or the rules, I guess. But personally, I try not to, my own rules are no graphic sex, no graphic violence. I guess that the definition of that graphic violence would vary from person to person, but my books aren't particularly graphic in that way, or bloody. Not always, anyway. Sometimes the plot demands it, but you know, graphic language, you know, there are certain things that I try to do because of my roots were as a YA author, and I had mother-daughter, you know, grandmother-granddaughter readers back in the day. So it was just knee-jerk reaction for me back then. And I kind of let the story carry, you know, create the tension in a lot of ways. So that's just my own personal preference.
Gotcha. Your roots in YA, what led you to writing more adult fiction?
It was that the YA market that I was writing in just completely collapsed at that time. And, you know, I had done a couple of books, I had contracts, and then all of a sudden the publisher said, you know, it just stopped. The entire industry shifted and young adult wasn't as hot as it had been. And so my editor said to me, why don't you try your hand at writing an adult, you know, an adult suspense novel. And that is how I began. I always thought that I'd just write YA. And that was satisfying for me at the time. And then when I did try an adult novel, it felt right as well. So I kind of expanded and would do either at this point. But I'm better known now for my adult fiction, my adult suspense.
Well, that's the truth of being a professional writer, isn't it? Sometimes the market that has been successful for you just dries up. And if you're a professional, you have to figure out how to shift gears and connect with an audience in a different genre. And you've just got to be flexible enough to do that. Are there any things that you've learned along the way that help you do that? Or is it just the professional mindset?
I think it's the commercial mindset. I think it's in terms of, well, certainly early in my career, it was that I never wanted to go back to having a different, you know, a day job, a corporate day job. So I was willing to, I loved writing and I would do any kind of writing as long as I didn't have to go back to a commute and a desk. And it turns out, you know, I write more and I work longer hours these days and have as a writer than I ever would have back then. But I think that for me, it works because it's what I love to do. So that's always in the back of my mind. I'm driven by this is my job. And, you know, I don't necessarily get to dictate what's going to sell. And so if I see something shifting, I need to adapt accordingly. And I try to keep that in mind Because my passion isn't, you know, like I said, I'd love to write another historical, a recent historical. Do I know whether that's going to be hot a couple of years from now when it would be coming out? No. So, and I don't know that that's what anybody would want to acquire. So you kind of balance the creativity and the inspiration with the market and reality. And the marketplace is ever changing. You know, that's the one constant in this business.
Exactly. Exactly. Last year when you were on, we talked about your new book, Little Girl Lost, the first in the Foundlings trilogy. The second, Dead Silence, is out now. What is a foundling?
A foundling, good question, because I didn't know until I conceived this trilogy. A foundling is an abandoned baby. It's a baby that's been found, or a child who's been found. I suppose it could also be like an adult with amnesia. It's somebody who comes to you with no background, no past, no clue to who they are. And to me, that was just a fascinating concept. And I just, when I conceived this, I wasn't sure exactly where I was going with the suspense plot, but I knew that I wanted to write about someone who has no idea who they are or where they came from or their biological roots. You know, that just spoke to me. My great-grandfather was a foundling, I found out. So, you know, to me, it's sort of, how did he go on to live this productive life as a family man and raise, you know, he had 13 children and very happy family life. Did he always wonder who his parents really were? And was it, you know, did he carry that as a burden or did he sort of move on? I don't know. He died before I was born, but I've been trying to find out who he was in the course of all of this through DNA research. So it's taken on like a personal, personal angle for me. Yeah.
So much fun. We've been doing some DNA research in our family as well, and man, you better be prepared for anything.
Oh yeah, because take that family tree. Yeah, you never know.
That's right. It can be so much fun.
Yeah, and you find people. You know, that's interesting. That's the fun part of it. Like, I've met so many people, my blood connected to theirs, and you know, or we try to piece together, like, how the heck are we cousins, you know, because I've known you all my life, how are you, you know, but we're family. So that's really interesting and great and fun.
Well, the main character, if you want, in the story is Amelia, and she's an investigative genealogist. What does that mean? And has her work and her quest, has that informed your own personal journey and the things that you've been finding out about your family?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So an investigative genealogist is a person who basically delves into other people's, you know, ancestry and helps them uncover their genealogical roots. I've read a few books by investigative genealogists, and I've certainly watched some television shows. I love, you know, like Who Do You Think You Are is on, and I think it's still, I don't know if they have a new season, but anyway, they'll go into somebody's past. And I'm just fascinated when they take out that dusty old volume that, you know, from the 1600s in a courthouse somewhere. And it's just, you know, that kind of thing just speaks to me personally and emotionally. And so I've done so much research on my own into my own family, but also just into these people who uncover for others their roots. So that's what Amelia does. That's what my heroine does in this book. But she is a foundling, and she, I guess, kind of does this because it's cathartic for her, because she doesn't know who she really is. But she grows up to become an investigative genealogist. So as her own quest continues, she helps others find out who they are or were.
Where did she come from? How did this story start unfolding for you?
I conceived the idea that and there's a twist, so I don't want to give any spoilers, but I conceived it sort of fully formed, I guess. So I can't really tell you. There's some specifics that I'm not going to go into. But I got just, it was that what if framed against the era. So she was born in the 60s. She was born in 68. There was so much going on in America or around the world, basically. At that time, it was a really turbulent year. And I framed it against that history and the unrest and the uneasiness in this country. And I thought, so the concept was born out of that, out of a few what ifs. She was abandoned in a Harlem church on Mother's Day, 1968. And so that's where her story springboards. And then in the third book, which I'm writing now, we go back to 67 and sort of you find out where she's coming from. And at the same time, there's another plot interwoven. It's another character I have. This is, I think, his sixth book that he's in. It's an NYPD missing persons detective. Stockton Barnes is his name. And my readers really loved him, and he kind of resonated the first book he appeared in. And so I brought him back now repeatedly. And his story is intertwined with Amelia's. It just sort of worked out that way. And it felt to me, once I realized where I was going, felt like it had always been meant to be. It was organic. And I can't give away more than that. But the third book should be satisfying for Amelia and Stockton Barnes and my readers and myself.
I love it. Wendy, in the process of writing 90 plus books, how has your writing process changed?
You know, interestingly, and I was giving a talk yesterday to a group of MFA students, and I got a similar question, and I kind of realized the answer as I was giving it. You know, I have recently only started giving myself permission to write in a non-linear way when I'm writing, because let's say, like in this book, I used to write every scene as it unfolded, and then I would give myself permission later. Obviously, you have to chop things up and move things around, and you know, sometimes chapter five becomes the opening and that kind of thing. But this is, in terms of process, I'm right now writing the thread that goes through 1967 into 1968, and I'm following a character along. And instead of letting the present story unfold and then inserting, you know, where I need to, I'm just writing from one character's viewpoint, and then I'll go back and write the other character's viewpoint from that. Those scenes just kind of felt more natural to me than structuring it the way it will be structured later. And in the last book, in Little Girl Lot, or in Dead Silence, actually, that's this book that we're talking about, I wrote the final two scenes about a third of the way into the book because I kind of needed to visualize that. I realized I can't wait to write this. It was an epilogue scene. There were two of them. And I just felt like, you know what, I need to write these now so I know that's what I'm writing toward. And I was kind of didn't feel comfortable feeling my way. So that's a departure. I always have written in the past. I've written in order, you know, scene by scene, beginning to end.
I love that idea of writing out of order and as they come to you and writing the thing that's exciting at the moment and then filing that away and then writing up to it. I love the idea of that. I think where I get hung up is in the logistics of that. How do you track all that stuff? And how do you keep track of, oh, I've written a scene that would work well here. Let me go pull that in. Like what are you doing to organize that writing?
I kind of, you know, I would never show anyone my work in progress because it's a mess, basically, at a glance, at the first glance, you know, looking at it, it would be so fragmented, but I know it so well. I've been living in it for months now. So it's all in one document. And I drop notes to myself at the end. And sometimes I will drop a chunk of, you know, dialogue or something at the end. And I know where it is. I'm so familiar with it that organization becomes second nature by this time, just because I've looked at it all day, every day, you know, so I wish I were a person with a poster board and little sticky notes all over it that I could move around and visualize that way. Cause that would probably be a great idea. I'm not organized enough to do that. So
you say that that you just write in one document and that you're so familiar with it, you know where it is. Are you just writing in Word? Is there any special software that you use?
Yeah, you know what? I'm back to Word. I don't love Word. I was a WordPerfect girl before I went over to Mac. I know I sound like a cranky old person, but I don't love Word. I don't love it, but I write in it because I tried Scrivener for a while. And that was good. It was great for organizing notes and, chapter by chapter, but it wasn't, it took so much time to try to get used to writing in that. I think I lost time, you know, so I'm back to Word and it's just the old fashioned way, I guess, for me for now until something, you know, it's interesting though, the script the script that my son and I collaborated on, he wouldn't write in Word. He refused. So we did his way, basically. And it was fine. It was fine. And we did it on a Google document that we were sharing and you know, screenwriting software I've used. And that was fine.
Oh, there's so many different pieces of software now. You could waste all of your time, and believe me, I've wasted plenty on trying this new package or that new package. And
really?
You know, at the end of the day, you just need to get words down. And
yep.
whatever
yep.
gets out of your way, for the most part, and that you can, you know, learn a few keyboard shortcuts that make your life a little bit easier, and just get words down. It's it can get a little ridiculous. Yeah.
Yeah, I always fantasize about, you know, I'll take a few weeks off and I'll learn something new. Old dog, new trick. But if I had a few weeks off, I find that I have other things like laundry that I should probably be doing. So it hasn't happened yet.
Exactly. Exactly. Wendy, do you ever work on more than one project at once?
I try not to work on in terms of novels, you know, I think that would be really difficult, and so I try not to do that. But I am writing in for screen now. I'm doing that at the same time as I'm writing my novel, and I don't have a problem switching back and forth because I think it's just so different, and it's not suspense, and it's just there's no confusion for me. It's very easy to keep separate. I would have a hard time writing a second novel, I think, at the same time.
Well, writing more than 90 books in your career, and you're like 28. So, like, how long do you give yourself to spend on a project?
It depends on how long the publisher has given me, because I really do write to deadline, and they're usually, you know, they don't seem so tight when I sign a contract, but then all the other stuff. gets involved, and you know, and then you're promoting a book, and you're, you know, and there's social media that you need to do, and just real life. So I give myself a deadline every Friday on my calendar, just a word count that I have to be on every Friday in the work in process. And it's just sort of geared toward, you know, my deadline for this one. You know, I know when it is, I know when it has to be, and I know how many words I have to have, so I work toward that. And it's just a matter of math, basically.
Well, Wendy, the new book, Dead Silence, we're going to send everybody to pick up their copy of it. It is out in mass market paperback, which I absolutely love because while I love trade paperbacks, I really like being able to throw it in my backpack or just you know, with me wherever I'm going, and it's super handy. Audiobook as well as Kindle edition. We'll put links to it in the show notes as well as last year's book so people can get caught up on the trilogy. The third book will be out next summer. Is that right?
Yeah, they actually said, I think it's an August title, should be on sale in July. It's currently called The Butcher's Daughter. That could change because this book was originally called Little Boy Blue. So and now it's Dead Silence. You never know, but it's tentatively, I like that title for it. So. Yeah.
Well, I know you have a website that's full of information about you and the books that you've written. Tell people where they can connect with you online.
Yes, it's www.wendycourseystab.com, and we just redid the website about a year ago, and it's now organized by series, by trilogy, by pseudonym, so it's pretty easy to navigate, eliminate some confusion for my readers. So, yeah.
Excellent.
And also, I would say, I'm on Facebook a lot. That's my social media of choice, and I like to communicate with readers there so they can find me, and I love to get to know my readers in real life. So find me there. I'm there a lot.
We'll do it. I'll link all that up in the show notes so people can find you easily. Wendy, I love the new series, and I'm a big fan. Thank you for coming back on the show, and let's do it again next summer.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Hank. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning into the Author Stories podcast. Be sure to subscribe at hankgarner.com or on your favorite podcasting app. Now stay tuned for an audiobook excerpt from Richard Gleaves, the Jason Crane series.
What in the name of Carl Sagan was he doing in the cemetery on Halloween? What was he thinking? He whirled, expecting the headless horseman himself to be waiting on the road ahead. Or was he lurking behind? He wanted to run, but now the bridge ahead worried him. Doesn't the horseman haunt bridges? Could he avoid crossing it somehow? It terrified him. Why? It was just a stupid bridge. The gloom beneath could have been the lair of a troll. Billy Goat's Gruff. Mama used to read that. The troll waits beneath for the fattest, sweetest goat. Jason thought he saw something on the far end of the bridge. A shape of some sort. He stepped onto the bridge and gripped the knotty railing. He felt the ground drop away beneath as he edged forward. His eyes remained on the shape. It's nothing. It's nothing. Is it nothing? No troll attacked him as he reached the other shore. The looming shape was only a stupid stairwell opposite the bridge that climbed up the hill and into the main cemetery. He turned left and ran, admitting defeat and letting the fear take him over. He ran southward down the long, dark road. His initial burst of adrenaline ran its course and he slowed, then walked again, limping a little. Headstones slipped past on the right. He still had enough light that he caught his reflection occasionally in the polished stone. He looked very young and very thin. He could feel his vulnerability as he walked along. He grew aware of his own body, the touch of his starchy dress shirt and his jacket and the soft weight of his backpack. He saw himself reflected in the headstones, just a container of warm fluids, flimsy work for a blade or a hoof or a sword. He felt shatterable and transient, and his next breath was not guaranteed, oh no. The leaves made a faint oceanic rustle all around. The insects sang their three-note songs. Jason Crane, Jason Crane, Jason Crane. Jason sang a wretched pop song as he walked, something about having no self-control and no bitches and not enough money. He sang it softly, absent-mindedly, as if reciting a psalm. He passed Reese, Finnerton, Bane, Ekdahl, Forest, Black, Small. There. He saw the gate at the end of the road. But the gate would be locked, he remembered. He would have to climb the embankment and cross over the churchyard. He could see the spire of the church above and the weather vane spinning against the sky. He would rather climb this gate than face that churchyard, but the spikes on top made leaping the fence impossible. Okay, just be quick. Something caught his ear, a brittle, clipping sound. He scanned the crest above and saw a horse silhouetted among the graves. It looked to be tied to a branch of the locust tree. He had heard its hooves as it shifted from foot to foot. It rustled somehow. His breath caught. He forced himself to be calm and rational. Some Halloween thing, maybe, for some event? He found the stairs and ascended, sideways, ready to bolt if necessary. He watched the horse, but when he neared the top he saw the rider, standing upon the shallow depression of the horseman's grave. The figure was motionless, a dim shape that absorbed light and gave nothing back. He could make out the shape of the boots and the legs and two arms held away from the body, palms down. Just a man? But the cape of the thing was not normal. It contorted painfully, twisting in the air even though the wind wasn't blowing. It wrung itself and billowed and whipped slowly, as if the figure wore a wave torn from a black ocean. And above its shoulders, is he headless? Is he headless?